Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 307, recorded Monday, July 24th, 2017. Seth Weintraub. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life, and that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with some of technology's biggest names, people who are moving and shaking in the technology industry and writing all about it, which is today's case. I'm Jason Howell, and I'm here. I love doing this show because I get to talk to some really smart people, and that is the case today. We're talking with Seth Weintraub, who is the founder, publisher, editorial director of the 9to5 Mac sites, also 9to5 Toys, 9to5 Google, basically all the 9to5 sites. If it's got 9to5 at the beginning, I'm assuming it's probably yours.
Yeah, I don't deal with Dolly Parton though. So
not yet. You've got expansion plans. I doubt they plan to go there. You've also got a recent site. Well, not really recent at this point. Electrek, which focuses on electric vehicles. Anyway, Seth, it's awesome to have you here. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure.
Appreciate getting you on. We actually got to chat a little bit at a Google I/O this last year. Do you go to Google I/O every year? Are you pretty much there without question?
Yeah, I think I'm like 8 years in a row now.
Right on.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Good to see people I haven't seen in a while. And in journalism and otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Some of the freebies that they give out, it's kind of slowed down a little bit, but I don't think anybody's that sad about that at this point.
Yeah, I used to walk away with like a grab bag full of like tablets and phones, and it was kind of crazy.
You kind of had to ask yourself, like, what am I going to do with all this stuff? What do I need it for? Really, it's for the developers so that they can get started on Google's big priorities and stuff. As journalists, maybe we review the technology, you know, on the site, but then that's kind of about it. So I think it makes sense what they're doing.
Well, Google's tightened up a little bit.
Absolutely. They've changed a lot over the years. So has Apple, of course. And we're going to get into all that. Obviously, you've created... Well, dare I say, kind of a media empire around your 9to5 sites. But I've been, you know, there's not many articles written about you, but going into this interview, I was like, I got to find out as much as I can about Seth. And there was one specific article. It was a Business Insider article. It was written, I think, back in 2014, but it did a good job of kind of highlighting the early years of Seth Weintraub. Tell us a little bit about kind of what it was like growing up, your passions, your hobbies that might lead you into this world of technology journalism.
Yeah, there's really no inkling that I would have been into this world from the get-go. I, you know, grew up in Ohio, went to school at USC for engineering, initially aerospace, then in industrial and systems engineering. Got a minor in multimedia creative technology, but, you know, went right into computers. Never really planned on being involved in writing. I enjoyed writing, but, you know, engineering and writing don't really overlap too much.
Yeah.
So, you know, I spent 10 years in IT managing, you know, medium-sized companies, typically with both Apple and Windows environments. You know, I did SharePoint and all the things that, like, just kind of give me chills right now. You know, I was in a bad situation where I wasn't enjoying my job. My girlfriend at the time, now wife, got a fellowship to study in Paris, and, you know, we were in New York, and I was like, okay, I'm just gonna go. Like, I'm gonna quit my job, and, you know, this is I'm gonna figure out what I want to do with my life here.
I feel like I'm constantly figuring out what I want to do with my life. So I understand that completely. That seemed like a nice clean break though. When you relocate like that, it kind of forces you to reevaluate things and maybe look at it with a clean slate.
especially when you can barely communicate with everybody around. My French is poor, to say the least. So, you know, I was kind of on the computer and communicating with some journalist friends I knew at Computer World and some other places, got some writing gigs, started blogging about the technology that I use, enterprise technology at Computer World. That turned out well. I used, you know, social networks that were kind of starting up at the time, but Dig and other sites to kind of share my work. And that grew. Computer World liked what I did. They gave me a blog outlet to write on. And then, you know, you're 6 hours ahead, so you're writing. You don't know what they're going to take and what they're not going to take. So whatever Computer World didn't take, I put on my own site, which, like, I just, you know, putting together stuff, called it 9to5Mac. Like, this is what you're doing at work. So created a little logo, started writing stuff. A friend of mine from the childhood happened to work at Apple, or actually with one of Apple's contractors, and had a whole bunch of scoops for me. And yada, yada, yada. Now I'm getting, you know, hundreds of thousands of page views. And I don't really need to go back to IT work necessarily.
Well, and that's an important switch, obviously, right there. In the beginning, I have to imagine, you know, you're doing this to supplement. Did you have any idea early on that this might eventually turn into something that could kind of be what you did when you grew up?
It's funny because initially I got into it because I was interested in CMSs, and I had originally started with Drupal. But, you know, WordPress is taking over the world. So, you know, somewhere along the line, we switched over to WordPress. But a lot of the early interest I had was just to learn how to use Drupal and other CMSs that I was playing with. And I also, one of the first jobs I had in Paris, because there was nothing for English-speaking people to do, you know, work-wise. There's plenty of fun things to do. But was for a site called CMS Wire. And so to get smart about that, I started installing Drupal and Joomla and a bunch of other CMSs and playing with them. And that's kind of one of the pieces of putting together 9to5Mac.
And, you know, you just mentioned kind of your connection to someone. I think the big break was I always called it the squatty iPod Nano. But it was basically the smaller
fatty.
Kind of fatty iPod Nano. And that kind of came out of nowhere. This was just a friend of yours that trusted you. I mean, being a new publication, a new site or whatever, you really, I have to imagine from your perspective, you have to prove to sources who might want to maybe release this information on the down low that you can protect that information, protect them from being discovered. I mean, once you do that one time, does that prove to others who might want to approach you, hey, they know what they're doing, this is a great outlet for this?
Yeah, I mean, so the first couple of times, not many people picked it up. You know, I think, you know, Think Secret back then, and, you know, the other Apple blogs kind of, you know, put it in the hearsay or it might be true kind of column. But sure. As things started to prove true, you know, people started following closer. And, you know, you bring up the fatty Nano. It's kind of a funny story because that's the first time one of my stories went beyond the rumor sites and, you know, like Engadget and, you know, all the other bigger sites of the day picked it up and said, I don't think this is going to really be true. This isn't going to happen. And then, oh, wait a minute, Apple lawyers just called us and told us to take these images down.
Yeah, that's
so
a sure sign
maybe
right there.
Maybe we're, you know, a little bit too early to judge that particular image. So when all that stuff started happening, we started to get the momentum. And I think that's like if you're starting a site or, you know, group of sites, the beginning is always the hardest. And I've recently gone through that with Electrek as well.
Yeah.
Is like getting the you know, momentum going and kind of getting the word out about the site. So that was what I needed to get 9to5Mac started. And because of those early leaks, we kind of got the initial audience. Then, you know, nowadays, or, you know, more recently, we've supplemented, you know, the rumors and the leaks with, you know, informed reporting, analysis, you know, how to's, great video work. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're a full kind of ecosystem of reporting. So, but to get that initial startup, that's what I think is the hardest part of building a site.
Yeah, absolutely. And making people think about you at the appropriate time, you know, that you have information that's vetted, that's important. I mean, how much were you breaking big news like this at the time? I mean, obviously the fatty iPod Nano was kind of the big breakthrough as far as kind of the bigger sites taking you seriously. But what other kind of big scoops were happening at the time? Do you remember some of those? Like,
we had the iPod Touch before it was announced. I mean, we started in 2007 between, you know, about 10 years ago, between the launch of the iPhone and the announcement of the iPhone and the launch. So there were things like the Bluetooth dock for the iPhone that we broke. And, you know, there was a lot of little tidbits of information, how long is the iPhone battery going to last, or, you know, is Apple going to lower prices, or all these like little things that, you know, clearly very important to Apple ecosystem folks, but maybe not something that's going to hit the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, there's a big difference between kind of the stuff that keeps the products going behind the scenes, the stuff that nerds, let's say, are going to really connect with, and the stuff that's like general consumer, like, oh, wow, that's an awesome feature. I would love to have that on my next phone. And, you know, that ends up being a front page news in that regard, which I feel like we see little bits of that right now, you know, around AR and other things like that. But did you have any sort of a switch between the two avenues, like, did you begin focused on one kind of avenue or level of Apple news and then realize that the consumer stuff was just way more appealing to a wider range of people?
That's exactly it. I mean, you know, initially I was doing a mix of, you know, here's how to set up a network of Macs using a Windows server. And, you know, there's probably like 1,000 people in the world who care about that.
Right.
You know, they're certainly very interested in that area, but, you know, if you're going to grow beyond that size, you've got to hit the general stuff. So, you know, I still have my 9-to-5 Mac name, but we're covering way more consumer-y stuff. And, because of that, you know, the site could grow beyond, just, the enterprise-y type reporting.
Yeah.
You know, we continue, I mean, to this day, we still report a lot of enterprise-y stuff. So, you know, I think a lot of systems administrators that, you know, run Apple networks probably still read the site, hopefully. But, you know, 98% of our viewership is the consumer level folks.
Yeah, it's good to have a well-rounded content. Also, you might as well fill in those gaps that other sites aren't doing. Going back to the beginning a little bit, though, how much support were you getting? You really bootstrapped this site. You had surplus content that you were creating, that you were writing around the time when you were started writing for Computer World. So you had all the site. So you had the content to throw there. You had to build up the site, and you say you created the logo and everything like that. Did you have much support at that point, or was it all on you?
It was all on me. I've never, you know, taken any money or really like even advice from anyone. Started kind of slow, but it's just me that I have to support, and, you know, I have a small family, but, you know, it wasn't ever like, this was never the plan. Mm-hmm. Until it was actually happening. And then I was like, oh, well, why am I working, you know, during the day when, you know, my night job is paying as much, if not more. And once that happened, then things really started to roll because, you know, I had time to do more sites and I had to, you know, had time to like manage people and not just, write my own stuff. And, you know, I have time to work on ads and do like better development work rather than just have, you know, my art skills can muster up. So,
sure.
You know, each step of the way, trying to do that as fast as I can, but, you know, having it develop naturally was, you know, just the way it worked best for me.
Yeah. At what point did that happen? Did 9to5 stop being a supplement to your life and start being the focus?
Well, when we came back from Paris, I had been doing IT work, you know, as well as the site in Paris. And then I came back with an ad agency, branding agency. But, you know, the work there wasn't great. It, you know, just like, you know, helped me print and all this other stuff. So meanwhile, I'm writing stories all day. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm done. I'm just going to write. And then Philip Elmer DeWitt, listeners probably know him from Fortune and he's doing his own site now, said, hey, you know, Fortune wants to do a Google site. I know you cover Google. I've been covering Google and Apple both for Computer World. They want a Google person and I think you'd be great for it. So I went in there fully expecting to say no. And Dan Roth, who's now at LinkedIn, made a really good pitch and you know, offered a lot of money. So yeah, it helped. And I was like, okay, I'll give it a try. It'll give me more access to, and that's one of the problems I had, you know, being a one person blogging team, you know, you don't get access to like the big companies, obviously Apple and Google, but even like the peripheral makers, like, you know, or smaller companies like Adobe or, Epson or whoever, they don't really know who you are, but when you work at Fortune, everybody's heard of Fortune. They respond to your emails and they give you a bunch of stuff to review. So that was a good choice. That was a good move on my part. I did a year at Fortune. Some great people there. You know, I don't know if I. It was interesting because I was seeing as much traffic on 9to5 Mac as I was as you know we'd have access to the back end of Fortune and. You know, for the most part, Fortune would get the same page views as 9to5 Mac. So I have 9to5 Mac, which is one person or, you know, maybe a couple people at that point. And then I have this company that I'm working for that has like 250 people on this floor of a skyscraper with like, you know, a person that does every single imaginable thing. And they're both getting the same page views. Obviously, Fortune has the very lucrative paper magazine. But I was like, you know, this one's not sustainable. This one's very sustainable.
So, okay. So Fortune, obviously that was a big turning point, for you, mm-hmm. at least from an access standpoint, as you're saying, also from an exposure standpoint, a lot of people kind of, you know, more inclined to recognize your name, recognize your byline and, connect with your content there. One question I have about that though, is so you're working for this major publication, Fortune, and then you've also got to support your own site with content. How do you manage to keep that content split between those publications without kind of stepping on any toes? Is it that Fortune was more focused on Google at the moment, at that point in time, and your site was more focused on Apple? Was it as easy as that?
That's exactly it. The problem was is I'd be working on Google pieces and Big Apple News would come out and I'd be like, I can't do this right now. So I at that point started hiring people to cover the day shift while I was at Fortune. And then, you know, in the evenings or whatever, I would come in and do Apple stuff. But you're right. I mean, it was, you know, this thing and, you know, like whenever there was an Apple versus Google thing, which, you know, those things happen all the time now. There was always this conflict like, well, I should write about this for Fortune, but it's, you know, 6:30 and I'm now at home and I should write about this for Apple. So, you know, I don't think Fortune was a big fan of the situation, sure. As it existed, but they were good sports about it.
Yeah.
But you know, it was, I think it was something that was untenable long term. And that's why after a year, you know, we kind of both decided to part ways.
Yeah. But a lot of experience gained from a situation like that as well. So,
yeah.
Talking about Apple a little bit, reporting on Apple, just Apple, I mean, Apple is the company that we all know and follow. They have so many, you know, so many new technologies advancing at all times, most of which you don't know about until suddenly you know about it, which makes it a really competitive company to cover. What's the secret sauce? How do you manage to kind of break these news items before other people? I mean, it's a really competitive thing to do. So it's got to be a big success when you're able to do it before anybody else does.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's the big game. And, you know, I don't know how much, you know, if we're 5 minutes ahead of our competitors, you know, it certainly appears in the Twitter feed earlier and maybe more people share it, but, getting those exclusives is always like a big deal. You know, it's not only the SEO from the incoming links and the word of mouth and the, you know, people from all over the world hear about your name through incoming links. But, you know, it's also like in journalistic circles, it's about having the reputation of, hey, we're not just copying everybody else's stuff. We're actually producing, you know, what the world is talking about today, or at least, you know, what the Apple world is talking about today. And I think people, you know, that brings a little bit of respect you know, like, hey, you know, Fortune magazine gets to talk about, you know, let's say a new iPod Touch because, you know, we broke the story and they're going to get all these page views and, you know, of course, they'll link to us. But, you know, we're helping out everybody because we're giving people something to talk about. So, I think, you know, bringing that to the table, really helped us build momentum.
Yeah. There's the, on one hand, there is actually doing the work that's required to break the news and investigate and find these things, which we'll talk about Mark Gurman in a second, because that's another big part of the success of the site, I would say, in that regard. But then on the other hand, there's everyone else that didn't quite break the story, but still feels like they have to have some sort of coverage on it. Plus, you've got, you know, 24 hours out of a day, so I'm sure everybody kind of does that a little bit. Somebody breaks some news, everybody else writes their own takes on it or whatever. How do you feel about kind of like the reblogging culture that has emerged in online publications?
You know, I've evolved my ideas on that. Initially, I hated it because I'm like, hey, you know, you guys are getting all my page views and you're putting a little link at the bottom, and it's not fair. Like, whatever. But you know, this is the way the world is. Like, I think, you know, I've had this discussion with Mark Gurman tons of times. Like, you know, like there's like, you can hate it. Like, people, you know, they're going to act like dicks and they're going to barely link to you, or they're going to, you know, say they came up with this, you know, whatever, or, you know, the real shady sites will just, you know, pretend that they did it, or they'll crop out your little watermark, or, you know, do all those things. But that's just the way the world works, and, like, you know, we just have to deal with this playing field that we're given. And you know, I think it's not really worth spending time, you know, hating these things.
For sure.
That said, like, there's these there's a lot of news sites out there that all they do is reblog. I mean, that's their model. And, you know, for me, it's a little sad because, like, the real investigative reporters out there, you know, should be, you know, millionaires because they should get all these clicks. But the reality is everybody's going to take a little bit of that. And, you know, it's not whether I think it's fair or not. It's just the way the world is.
Yeah. And readers are going to find the site that they identify with, the, kind of the, I don't know, the voice that's being portrayed in the writing. And that just ends up being the site that they follow, whether it's reblogging or whether it's that site is specifically breaking the news. They follow those people on that site, or that personality of that site. Yeah, I suppose it's kind of pointless to want to fight against it. It's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's taken years of therapy to get me to this point. So.
You've evolved, I could tell, Seth. Did you ever get a chance to meet Steve Jobs?
I did, but not in reporting. One of the brand agencies I had worked with prior to being a writer was doing the Project Red, the Product Red. Mm-hmm. Thing. And, you know, we had Bono in one time and a couple other folks from Red. And then one day, like, the CEO comes to me and he's like, you know, hey, this is a big deal. Steve Jobs is coming in. And I was like, well, you know what? Like, cause you know, I'm obviously pretty up to date on Apple stuff, but I wasn't like, you know, a Steve Jobs disciple at that point. So, he came in and, I guess he grilled, our branding team on, you know, how everything they did was, and I think there were people in tears. But you know, we were almost entirely a Mac shop. I think we had like one Windows PC to, you know, check PowerPoints before they went out. So he came in and he saw all the Macs and he, you know, gave me a pat on the back for not having any Windows machines. And also our office was like completely white and it kind of looked like an Apple store. So I think he appreciated that a little bit. But that was it. I mean, you know, I think I saw him in the bathroom briefly, but, you know, that's my exposure to Steve Jobs.
Right on. I'm sure in retrospect around kind of the development of the site, you would hope to have some sort of interaction around the times of the site, but how does Apple, I don't know, how does Apple feel about a publication like 9 to 5 Mac always revealing their secrets? Maybe there wouldn't be much Steve Jobs interaction for your site.
No, not any positive interaction. Yeah. I think, you know, I think his reaction to the Gizmodo iPhone 4 thing kind of gives you a insight into his feelings if they weren't obvious already. So, you know, he wanted to be the be all and end all of news out of Apple. So, you know, I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think he probably would have been a huge fan of the work we did, but, you know, I think Apple, the new Apple, the Tim Cook's Apple, has been a little bit more forthcoming and open to talking to us. You know, before we wouldn't get anything except from Apple lawyers. But now, you know, the PR team is reaching out to a lot of our writers. You know, we're not, Jordan Kahn just went to WWDC on, you know, as press. So, we're kind of becoming, you know, into the Apple thing. I think as more companies are, you know, like, hey, Bloomberg's got Mark Gurman now. So, right. You know, what are you going to do? Just like blacklist Bloomberg because, you know, they're talking about your products before launch. So I think Apple's become more realistic and the expectations, you know, like, hey, we're a pretty huge Apple site, a huge amount of people that love Apple products come to our site every day. Let's interact. And you know, if we've got a story wrong or if we can be helped in any way, I think Apple knows that they can come to us and whenever we have a story that's kind of a big deal, we go to them and, you know, we don't say, hey, you know, we're going to post this, but we're going to say, hey, you know, this is what we're going to post. You know, if you have any comment on it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a rare instance, they'll actually talk to us.
Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, Apple has historically been super secretive. It's nice to come out with a surprise when a release happens. But at the same time, you know, little bits of information that hit along the way builds a lot of excitement as well. So maybe there's a little bit of a realization that actually does help in the release of a product as well, especially right now. This was a question that I had for you around consumer technology, and smartphones is just one example. I mean, things have matured so much in the past 10 years, specifically related to smartphones, almost to a point to where it's really difficult to excite people around new features. Do you feel that's the way it is right now, the way it's kind of been culminating? And how do you manage to kind of try to keep things exciting when it comes to the news?
That's a great question. We are feeling that. It's not just, you know, our page views are great. Like, we're still growing significantly. But, like, the subject matter we cover, you know, iPhone typically and the ecosystem around that and, you know, on the other sites, Android, they're kind of like, you know, they're kind of mature, you know, to put it mildly. And there's not many things that they can do that they can't do now, like, you know, or that you can think of that they can do. And so, you know, we're spending a lot more time on the ecosystem stuff and what, you know, and how you live your life and how, you know, the home automation and, you know, the Siri smart speaker and, you know, just tons of things that you can do with your smartphone as the hub or Internet of Things or, you know, whatever, the smartphone enables, I guess. And that's still growing. And I think that's still an extremely interesting field. You know, this AR kit for me in the Apple world right now, the AR kits is what is the coolest stuff coming out. And I think that, you know, we've got a good year of just like crazy thing after crazy thing after crazy thing, you know, on daily, if not, you know, weekly, if not daily basis. So I'm not worried about it getting too boring. I know it's getting a little bit more boring, but you know, we're fine with it.
Yeah, maybe it's evolved a little bit from this has a better camera to this does this really unique augmented reality sort of experience. Here, let me show you with a video, and you go, wow, that's really cool. I mean, what Apple is doing with ARKit has really blown me away, and I've been a big fan of following what Google's been doing with Project Tango. Then Apple comes out, you know, and it seemed very just like, oh, and by the way, we've got this ARKit thing going. Yet it, in retrospect, over the last month or two since we've known about it, it really feels like it's building to be one of the big, potentially big features of the next set of iPhones.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the thing that I'm looking forward to the most once it goes out of beta. And then, you know, obviously there's the, well, what does this enable? I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you could do a Google Glass type of application, but also, you know, Apple's big into cars and, you know, a heads up display in a car would use ARKit, you know, CarPlay 3.0, like maybe, you know, you're driving down the road and there's just this arrow like on the street that you're supposed to go on. I mean, that would be cool. So there's just so many things that you can do with like this kind of technology that, you know, I think we're barely scratching the surface at this point.
Absolutely. We're going to take a quick break and thank the sponsor of today's episode. And then we'll come back, talk a little bit about Mark Gurman, of course, you know, how everything's evolved to your other 9-to-5 sites, and then Electrek, and maybe even another site that people don't know a whole lot about yet. You've got a lot cooking right now. But let's take a quick moment and thank the sponsor of today's episode of Triangulation. That is Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. If you've ever gone through the mortgage process, you know it's not the easiest process in the world. And we're so used to living our lives online, doing things with convenience in the digital realm. And Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, that's kind of what they're all about. They're all about taking that process that it wasn't so easy before and moving it into the digital age and keeping up with the times. The whole process before was just dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home. You can use it to refinance as well. It's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details, be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient, of course. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. They make it super easy. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or even your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds, so you know exactly what you can get, all of your options. It's based on your income, your assets, and your credit, and Rocket Mortgage just analyzes all of your home loan options for which you qualify specifically and then can help you find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, all you have to do is go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. That's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of Triangulation. So we've already mentioned his name a few times here. And it, I mean, when I think of of 9 to 5 Mac, I will always think of Mark Gurman, because he was so, I mean, his name was attached to so many big stories. How did you meet Mark Gurman? He was young when he started working for 9 to 5 Mac.
Yeah, he's in high school. It was kind of weird. He kept tipping, I think he tipped to the other sites, but he kept tipping 9 to 5 Mac. And I think it was around Apple filing trademarks for the iPad. So this was, you know, quite a while ago. And I was like, hey, you know, you're fairly into this stuff. You're pretty deep into this. And this is right when I had started hiring new writers. I think it was still at Fortune. So I was like, hey, have you ever considered writing? And he was like, you know, all over it, like definitely wanted to do it. Obviously, you know, I think he was like in a junior or something in high school or sophomore or something. So his writing skills weren't great, but he would, you know, write something up that he, you know, found investigating. And, you know, I would go through, and at the beginning it was some pretty heavy editing, but eventually, you know, I would, you know, toward the end, there was obviously no editing needed. But, you know, you don't see that type of tenacity and curiosity very often. I certainly don't. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when somebody's that into it, it doesn't really matter if they're in high school or it could be 85 years old or whatever. They're just so into the Apple space and so tenacious and so determined that, you know, you can't really even stop them if you wanted to. Even if I had told him, hey, you know, there's nothing going on here, he'd still tip and he'd still be doing this stuff. So, yeah. And that's kind of the joke I told him. I said, you know, like, I want you to have, like, you know, a life in high school and college, like go out and you know, he would just be turning out these crazy, amazing stories. And I'd feel kind of guilty. And he's like, well, you know, if I wasn't doing this for you, I'd be doing it anyway. So don't feel guilty about that. You know, it's just a personality thing. I think he's just born with that type of, you know, desire to investigate and this curiosity. I mean, I think that's what you really need to do this kind of work, is this intense curiosity.
Yeah, curiosity coupled with that drive and that passion around mm-hmm. the space, because he was obviously very, very avid, avidly following Apple from a passion standpoint. He'd be mm-hmm. really connected with what they were doing. I mean, but in order to pull that off when you're so young, as Mark was when he started writing, like he has to be well connected to some degree, right? Because anybody could go online and be like, I'm going to dig into some dirt and find something to scoop for Apple. And maybe there's just not anything there. You almost need you need some sort of a connection that can kind of link the idea up with you. Was that the case with
Mark? He didn't have any inherent connections. There wasn't any like family, friends or anything. He would just go and, you know, research the heck out of somebody in, you know, LinkedIn profiles and cross that with, you know, just phone numbers, and he would get a hold of these people online and start talking to them. And you know, I would get complaints sometimes from people either at Apple or associated with Apple, like, hey, this dude keeps like pestering me, like tell him to stop pestering me. And you know, that's you know, I guess part of the game, but
that's what it takes.
It's what it takes. I mean, you know, you can't argue with the results.
Absolutely. How did you take the news about Bloomberg? Because Mark Gurman, of course, recently transitioned over to Bloomberg. I think, was it late last year? I know it
was mid last year. Yeah.
Yeah. When that happened, everybody was writing about it. That's how you know that Mark Gurman was such a big deal, because everybody took note.
Yeah. You know, for years we had talked about, like, you know, he wanted to be on TV a little bit more. He wanted to do, you know, kind of expand his coverage. You know, I think he's covering everything now there at Bloomberg. So it was kind of like, you know, this is going to happen at some point. And that, you know, when, you know, and finally he told me about it, I was like, oh man, this sucks. And I was really bummed. Yeah. But, you know, I can't blame him. I mean, my advice to him, like my advice to him was always stay at 9-to-5 Mac. But once it was apparent that he was going to go, I was like, hey, dude, start your own site. Like, you know, don't these Bloomberg jokers, like build your own site. I'll show you how to do it. I'll, you know, I'll give you all my expertise in ads and development and, you know, all these things. But, you know, he's young and he doesn't know, you know, this from that. And Bloomberg offers a lot of really good opportunities. I think he's done really well there. So did he make the right choice? I probably did. Like, you know, who knows what would have happened if he started his own site. Me, as like a Mark Gurman fan, I would have liked to see him start his own site. Maybe in the future that'll happen. But, you know, he seems happy now and he's doing an amazing job at Bloomberg. You know, we obviously cover his stories when they pertain to Apple or now Google and whatever. So, you know, it was kind of inevitable. I mean, he was with us for so long and is kind of pigeonholed into like this one set of, you know, parameters. And now he's got a lot more options before him. And those options include starting his own site. So
potentially down the line. Yeah. There's no reason to think that the move to Bloomberg doesn't can only help in that process.
Right.
I imagine
right.
The more seasoned you become in all of these different directions, the better it can be. And he's got a great, you know, I hate to use the word brand, but he's got a great recognition around his name. So that
right. I mean, that was actually my major concern was, is he going to get buried under Bloomberg and he's just going to be another Bloomberg reporter? But I think he's managed to keep his name above that.
Absolutely. I would agree. Now, okay, so 9-to-5 Google, in comparison to 9-to-5 Mac, like how long did it take before 9-to-5 Google became like it became obvious to you that you had to open up this other site to cover the other major company doing major things?
So what had happened was that at Fortune, I had gotten this following of Google folks and, you know, and Fortune didn't have a 9-to-5 Google, you know, Twitter feed. So I just made one and, you know, I put it in the posts and I didn't have, they didn't even have a dedicated RSS feed at the time, I think. So I made one of those. And so I had this following at Fortune of, you know, people reading my stuff and this Twitter account that I owned and this feed and, you know, Facebook and all this stuff. So I was like, you know, like I have all this stuff, what should I do with it? And I was like, you know, I have this, I've been doing half Google, half Mac, you know, Apple for all this time. And now I'm no longer at Fortune. I have all these Google things. I might as well start a Google site. And, you know, hopefully I can bring it up to the level of 9-to-5 Mac. And, you know, while we haven't page view wise reached that point yet, I think, you know, in coverage, 9-to-5 Google is right up there with 9-to-5 Mac in terms of, you know, what we cover. We have very dedicated fans. We have, you know, we break a lot of exciting news, and Stephen Hall over there is doing a wonderful job. Yeah. So, and we've got a great bunch of writers. So, you know, a lot of times Google's a little bit more interesting than Apple. So it's kind of a little bit of a hedge from my perspective. And it was at the time, well, you know, if Apple's not always this crazy, amazing company and does all this crazy, amazing stuff that everybody's interested in, well, Google's going to certainly be interesting.
Yeah, I bet there are big differences between how you report on a company like Apple and a company like Google, because they treat secrecy differently. Google seems to come out ahead of things and let you into the process early on, for better or for worse. Apple right. historically has really kept things closed down, and they only really admit it once they absolutely have to.
Right. So let me give you a good example. You know how Apple treats leaks. I broke the Google Glass story. I don't know if you remember mm-hmm. that, but that was like a big one. So instead of, you know, sending the lawyers, Sergey Brin invited me for the first, you know, the tryout of Google Glass. And, you know, he was super cordial and, you know, he's like, you know, this is what I like to do. And I love taking pictures of my kids. And, you know, we had a face to face and, you know, I think it was at Google I.O., but I was like, wow, this is totally different. Like, you know, Apple is usually sending their lawyers after me and making threats. And, you know, Google is, I mean, obviously Glass didn't turn out to be as fantastic as we all hoped, but, you know, here's this guy who's really excited about this project and he's, you know, wants to share it with me rather than, you know, with, I kind of feel like there's an ego component to the Apple secrecy where like we want to be the sole, you know, like they have 100,000 employees, but like these four, you know, five guys want to be the ones who break the news to the world.
Sure.
So, and I think that's a lot of why we get secret sometimes is because people don't like that. But anyway, that's a little digression there.
Now, one thing, I mean, we talked a little bit about this with Mark Gurman. You mentioned Jordan Kahn and now Stephen Hall. They all, I mean, they're all younger. It almost seems like you, I mean, you enjoy playing the mentor, I think, in the world of journalism. Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, they're not like, I mean, Mark was an exceptional case in high school. But everybody in their earlier mid-20s. I mean, a lot of it, like, you know, when we pull people from traditional sites and, you know, we're working with them, they're kind of just like, oh, you know, like we're reblogging Gadget. That's like what we do. And I'm like, oh, that's not right. That's not like what we're about. We'd like people to actually go and find stuff. And so that's a hard person to find. So I kind of find that if we pull somebody, you know, who's got journalism school and like 5 years of, you know, some other blog, that we pull somebody in and that from that point, they never seem to work out or, you know, typically don't. So, you know, finding the guy on Reddit, you know, forums, who's like doing these amazing, you know, long posts and, you know, clearly has a lot of talent and a lot of, you know, he's doing it for free. So he obviously loves this stuff. Those to me are the people that I would have write for me. And, you know, I'm not so, I don't place a higher priority on, you know, is their grammar perfect or is their the writing perfect? You know, we have copy editors now that can kind of fix that stuff. So, you know, the curious is kind of what we're looking for.
Yeah, the curiosity. Yeah, Reddit is, man, I've heard of a lot of stories of really great writers coming from Reddit, and they may not have even ever considered journalism to be a thing that they would get into. They were just passionate and curious, like you said, and knew how to put that into words. That's the most important part. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I just looked up at the clock and I realized we're getting close here. We haven't even gotten into one of your most recent passions, and you and I talked about this a little bit at Google I.O., but that's electric cars. Where along the way did you kind of develop this fascination around electric cars and what Tesla's up to and all that?
You know, I'm not sure exactly where it was, but I remember when Tesla first came out with their Model S with the display and the Google Maps on the thing. And I think I might have covered that for Fortune or Computer World or something, because, you know, this new car is using this huge display of Google. And I think Google was rumored to have been in talks to buy Tesla. So, you know, this was obviously an area of technology that I was covering. But along the way, I fell in love with the car. I don't know if you remember, but when the Model S first came out, its starting price was $49,000. And, you know, we were looking at a Volt at the time, which was, I think, $42,000. You know, both of those cars kind of out of my, like, you know, we had a Prius before. And that's kind of, you know, we would spend like $20,000 on a car. So this was a big deal. But, you know, I talked to my wife and I was like, hey, this car is crazy. And it's $49,000. You know, we test drove it in 2012 in Santa Monica before they even came off the assembly line. And I was like, whoa, this thing is insane. Like, we went up this hill and it was like a rocket. And I was like, okay, I'm into this. I'm so into this. And I was ready to buy it right there. And they're like, no, you can't. You can put down some money and, you know, we have to wait, you know, whatever amount of months till we start making the super cheap version that you bought. So, you know, in the meantime, I was like, well, I like this company. I'm going to put some money into the Tesla stock. And, you know, that was a good move. Like, so I'm into the Tesla stock. I've got a car coming and I'm looking for news on Tesla all the time. And there's just a bunch of idiots talking about, you know, the high level stuff. Not idiots, but like, you know, I want to dive in deep like I do on the Apple site and the Google site. So, you know, I'm diving in deep. I'm going like the Tesla Reddit forum and all these things where you're really diving in deep in the other Tesla forums. And I'm like, you know, there's a lot of stuff in these forums that people are talking about that nobody's talking about in the sites. And I think that's what we are, is we're a group of like really enthusiast sites, you know, mm-hmm. you know, Apple enthusiasts, Google enthusiasts, Tesla. So there wasn't a Tesla enthusiast site. There was a couple, you know, kind of sites. There's a couple like, you know, generalists like green cars or whatever, but there's no like Tesla enthusiast site. So that's what I built. And I was like, you know, I'm building this as much for my own edification as I am, you know, to try to get readers. And, you know, it stayed kind of, I think I started in like 2013 and it stayed really small for a long time. But, you know, I found Frederick Lambert, who's a native Quebecois French speaker, but happens to write really well in English. I found him on Reddit, as we said before. And, you know, once I hired him, the site just like hockey sticked. Page views wise. So now I think we're the biggest EV car site. And ironically, now I'm covering, you know, when I write for Electrek, I'm covering mostly like Chevy Bolt and all the other non-Tesla things. And Fred often covers just Tesla stuff. And he's so deep into Tesla that, you know, it's almost scary. And it's a lot like Mark Gurman, where, you know, you can't contain him. You can only hope to like... You know, like sometimes you have to tell him, like, hey, it's time to go to bed. You've been writing for 16 hours now. So he's fantastic. Awesome. And it's so exciting to be working with somebody like that.
Yeah, obviously a lot of passion behind that. What would you say is the most challenging aspect of covering electric car technology versus consumer car technology?
Well, there's a $1 trillion industry that's being destroyed. And that $1 trillion industry doesn't want electric cars or solar or anything. It's the fossil fuels. Yeah. And it's not just, you know, the companies or the explorers or the trucks that drive those things around or the gas stations. All of this stuff is like going to go away if electric cars are going to win. And it, you know, a $1 trillion industry doesn't just roll over. So mm-hmm. we're seeing all this crazy, you know, media buys on, you know, with all these lies and videos and the Koch brothers. And it's just like, you know, it's a crazy, turbulent time in the EV industry. And, you know, it's fun to be part of it, but it's also kind of crazy.
And I imagine working as you have with Electrek over the years, I mean, it's one thing to test a new smartphone. It's another thing to test electric vehicles. How has that been for you? I mean, maybe that was even part of this, is that you were so passionate about it that by doing this, it brings you closer to these things that you're kind of lusting after to a certain degree. Does that mean you get to drive around all the cool cars now, basically?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, like tech reporters and car reporters are kind of a different breed.
Yeah.
And so making that switch, like, when a new car is launched, like a Hyundai Ioniq or a Chevy Bolt, they fly you out to see them, and then they put you in a really nice hotel and they feed you a lot of food for like days, and they give you anything you want. Whereas like, you know, an Apple event, you go there on your own dime, you're staying in your own hotel you bought, and you're getting maybe like a croissant, and you know, that's just a totally different world. And it's, you know, obviously coming from the tech world and walking into this like junket land of EVs is kind of eye opening for me. And then, you know, you get cars, like they drive a car to your house and they say, well, pick it up in a week. And I'm, you know, like, is 2 weeks better? I'm like, awesome, yeah. Whatever. I'll take it for a day. And so it's a totally different world, but it's amazing. And, you know, like, cars are obviously a big, you know, what do people spend on an iPhone? You know, they spend, you know, $700 a year. What do they spend on a car? Talking, you know, tens of thousands per year, you know, if you break it down over time. So it's a big deal. Like, there's a lot of money flying around. And, you know, joining this world and now, like, kind of leading the electric car charging. I mean, we're trying to be like the motor trend of electric cars in a few years when we believe that most cars will be electric. Mm-hmm. So doing this, it's making us, you know, it's a whole new thing for me. It's like, you know, starting all over again, almost. It's not just like 9to5 Mac and 9to5 Google. It's kind of a totally new world.
Right. Proving that you can take your passion and apply it into a completely different direction. You actually, back in 2013, you tweeted out something that I found leading up to today. You said, almost every car on the street right now will be valueless in 10 years. More or less, you said something along those lines. Have the past 3 years since that statement kind of supported your belief at that time? Do you think that's still
so
the case?
That tweet was in my – that was my, like, I need to start an electric car site. Like, thing. I was just seeing the autonomy thing, the ride-sharing thing, and the electrification thing all, like, happening. Yeah. Like, 2013, that was – like, all those things were just, like, becoming real. And I was like, this is crazy. Like, we know what ride-sharing is going to be everywhere. We know electrification, it may not be 100%. Of the market, but it's probably going to be, you know, a huge part of it. I don't want to say a majority, but like could be, I don't know, 10 years. And then, you know, the autonomy, like that's going to change the way we live. I mean, everybody knows that now, but like in 2013, that wasn't really a big idea. So all those things kind of coming into my brain at the same time, I was like, I got to make a site. And that was kind of my first salvo right there. So, And I kind of feel like it's happening. I mean, more and more people are kind of saying, you know, Bloomberg New Energy is saying that, you know, they're moving their targets like in, and even OPEC is moving their targets in, and like, okay, electrification is going to be a big deal. And what we said last year, minus 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I think it's happening. I mean, it feels like it's happening.
Yeah, it does. What do you think, you know, in this world, in the future of automotive technology, what is the thing that most excites you about this transition right now?
Well, as a parent, knowing that my kids aren't going to be driving with a bunch of their friends, yeah, well, they probably will be, but there will be an autonomous component to their vehicle, hopefully, that, you know, when my kid's, you know, having a rager with his buddies and you know, wants to drive fast, the car is like, hey dude, chill out, that's a red light, we're gonna stop at that, and you know, all these things. I don't have to think about that now, like, yeah. It, you know, because I remember when I was a kid and I was doing all kinds of crazy stuff, like, thank God I didn't, you know, anything bad didn't happen, but you know, I wasn't thinking about car wrecks or or anything. So as a parent, like, that's going to be concerned. Also, hey, I'm going to get old. Like, I'm not super old, but you know, at some point I'm going to be in my 80s, and I still want to be able to get around by myself without, you know, somebody to drive me. And theoretically, that's going to come. I mean, I would say, you know, I'm 40 something now. In 40 years, if not, you know, we're looking at 5 to 10 years, but in 40 years for sure, like, there's going to be autonomy. And so I don't have to worry about, like, you know, driving when I'm 80.
I hadn't even considered that, but that's so incredibly true. Just got back from a family reunion and kind of dealt with a few issues around that. And it was like, oh, hey, wait a minute. Maybe that's what we needed all along. The easy solution is autonomous vehicles right now. Gonna have to wait a little bit for that, but that's a really good point. So, okay, so obviously, things are going well with the 9to5 sites. Electrek is kicking butt. And then as I was kind of leading up to this, I checked out your Twitter profile, and there was a little blurb in there about something called Drone DJ. Tell me about that. What's going on?
So, you don't often see a company that does something so well as DJI has done with drones, and there's other drone makers like Unique and Parrot out there that do drones pretty well. But my feeling is that DJI is on a higher plane, and what they're doing with drones is remarkable. You know, the software and the hardware. So, you know, in the same sense that we cover Apple and Google, I want to start covering DJI and the other drone makers, equally. So all the domains around drones are taken. So we went for weeks and tried to find a good name, and now we've got DroneDJ.com, and I've got one writer lined up. Another couple writers from the other sites are interested. So we're putting that together, and probably by the end of the year, we'll have a site going.
That's awesome. DJI obviously dominates to a large degree in this space. How does that affect content when one manufacturer dominates so much over the competition, I guess?
That's kind of what we're playing to. It's not good in the long run. Like, Amazon just dominating retail right now, and that's not healthy. DJI, like, I guess if they knock out all the other drone makers, that's probably not going to be healthy. But, they're doing a really good job. Like, yeah. Their software is great, and their hardware is great. And it's so much better than everything else out there that, it's hard to fault a company like that for doing so well.
For sure. Final question. This is kind of the forward-looking, looking to, the crystal ball. 20 years from now, everything goes the way you plan. Where do you envision you are 20 years from now? What would you be doing, best case scenario?
It's funny. We were just thinking 10-year plans.
Yeah.
So 20-year plans, let's see. I don't know. My kids are off. I imagine I'm doing some traveling. It would be weird, because we were travelers before. My wife and I were travelers before we had kids, and now we're kind of planted. But our kids will be, my youngest is in kindergarten right now, so we will probably be out of our house and either on the open road or whatever.
In your electric vehicle, in your Tesla,
being driven around by this AI that's telling us where to go. I'm also a pilot, and that's something else I want to get back into. My wife's been like, hey, why don't you let the kids get into high school before you die in a plane crash? Put the kibosh on the flying, and then hopefully in a few years that AI technology and the autonomy moves into planes, so maybe I can get back up in the air again safely and get back to that enjoyment of flying.
Yeah, that'll be in the point of all of our lives where flying cars is a normal thing, and
Right. Everybody's
in the air. We don't even have to know how to fly, because it's just kind of flying us for us. So,
yeah, I mean, I think about that, but then also it kind of sucks to just see a bunch of things flying around your head all the time,
little shadows passing over you at all times,
Right. Basically.
Seth Weintraub, it's been a real pleasure sitting down and chatting with you about everything that you've done. Obviously, we're big fans of all of the everything that you're publishing on your 9to5 sites and Electrek. We feature it on our shows all the time because you guys continue to break awesome news and just have great writers and everything. So founder, publisher, editorial director of the 9to5 Mac, 9to5 Google, 9to5 Toys, which we didn't mention, although there's lots of really great deals that appear on 9to5 Toys. So if you're a deal hunter, definitely check that out. And Electrek, and then coming soon, Drone DJ. So check out that as well. Seth, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Absolutely. We'll have you back soon. Thanks again. Triangulation, we do this show every Monday. We record it live, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 1800 UTC. You can go to twit.tv/live to catch it live. If you miss it live, though, you don't have to worry about it. We publish it as we do all of our shows on Twit. If you go to twit.tv/TRI or triangulation, you'll get to our show page and you can find all of the episodes, all of the interviews. We have quite a few of them at this point. I think this is episode 307. So you got a lot of catching up to do if you missed any of these. I'm Jason Howell. Thanks for watching this episode of Triangulation. We'll see you again soon.